So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove. The legend of the Battle of the Alamo is not only an intrinsic part of Texas lore, but is enshrined in the American imagination. A band of fiery rebels fighting for independence who die as martyrs in the cause of liberty. But a new book, Forget the Alamo, argues that the Alamo myth is just that, an allegory that tells us what we want to believe about the Alamo, but not what actually happened. Written by Texas authors Brian Burrow, Chris Tomlinson, and Jason Stanford, Forget the Alamo has not been without its critics. A recent event booked at the Texas State History Museum was canceled by Texas's Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who called it a fact-free rewriting of Texas history. My friend and colleague, LBJ Library Director Mark Lawrence, talked to two of the book's authors, Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson, about what history really tells us about the Battle of the Alamo and why the myth that so many want to preserve has endured for so long.
Well, welcome everyone, and thanks a million to Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson for joining me today. Chris and Brian, the first thing to say, I think, is congratulations on this fantastically provocative and engaging book, this work of revisionist history about the Battle of the Alamo and all of the legend-making and mythologizing that's happened over the many, many decades ever since 1836. The book was a real pleasure to read, and I got to say, one of the things I really appreciated about it is not only is there a lot of great material here, but you present it in such a lively and entertaining way that I think this book is going to, already has, no doubt, but is certainly going to reach a broad audience. So we all owe you a big word of thanks, I think, for pushing us to think again about some important moments in the history of Texas and, in many ways, in the history of the country. I want, of course, to spend most of our time talking about the book itself. That's why we're here. But I can't resist the temptation to start out not with the book, but with the reception that it's gotten. You appear, to put it mildly, to have hit a nerve. The book has been widely and very positively reviewed, and it's also been at the center of a political firestorm here in Texas, with no less than the lieutenant governor himself taking action a couple of weeks to stop you from taking part in an event hosted by the Bullock Museum of Texas History here in Austin. Brian, let me start with you and ask, what do you make of this reception that your book has received? Did you see this coming, or has it taken you by surprise?
Thanks, Mark. Has it taken us by surprise? It has been overwhelming. I can't speak for Chris or Jason, but, you know, I thought this was going to be a little side project we'd do in the weekends and in the evenings, and we'd put it out, and it would be a nice little regional book, and maybe we'd have some nice conversations on NPR in Austin and Dallas, and we'd, you know, go back to our lives. And before this even came out, it began getting attention on the coasts that utterly, that stunned me. I mean, we've had a couple of pieces in the LA Times, five mentions in the New York Times, writing pieces for the Washington Post, for Time Magazine. And then, as you say, the lieutenant governor got involved and turned the book from a conversation about reassessing Texas history, about rediscovering the actual historical Alamo. We became this First Amendment beacon for a lot of people, and there's upside and downside to that, but needless to say, with most books that you put out, what, now 5 weeks ago, we're done talking about it, and Chris and I are still talking about it, and we still have people lined up to be talking about it. So I will say that it's immensely gratifying just to understand that obviously a lot of people connect with the material, connect with the subject matter, and so it makes you feel that we've done our jobs.
Chris, you say in the book that you want to promote dialogue on the Alamo and all that it represents and has represented for so many decades. Do you think you're having that effect with the book of promoting that kind of dialogue, or is it just leading to more people shouting past each other from their preconceived positions about Texas history?
Well, I think we've started the dialogue, and I think that many dialogues begin with people shouting. You know, that's just how it's going to start. Both sides are pretty entrenched in their positions. But the longer we engage, I think the more the volume will come down and the more people realize that the stories we're telling aren't all that different. All we're talking about is changing the framing just a little bit. Just change the frame from which you view what happened in 1836. And you come up with a very different story. And of course, for so many things like the Civil War or even World War II, and the Vietnam War, which, you know, we've got people alive who fought in it. Vietnam veterans go and meet North Vietnamese soldiers in the Viet Cong in Hanoi. You know, why we can't have Tejanos and Chicanos sit down with the Anglo traditionalists and talk about what happened and break bread together over it. I'm hoping that's where we're headed, but we're clearly not there yet.
There were so many things that surprised me about the research, but I don't think I was surprised by anything more than beginning to understand how oppressive and how harmful the traditional Anglo-centric narrative has been to our Tejano brethren. How just painful this idea that Mexicans killed Davy has been used for decades to really beat them down. And the amazing thing was, when you go out there and talk to, very unscientifically, all our Anglo friends, not a single one had ever heard of this. And I don't necessarily blame them. If there's criticism, you could well say it's because Tejanos have not pushed this message into the mainstream. And I'm keenly aware that as three middle-aged white guys, we may not be the ideal messengers for this, but I just had coffee with some top Tejano historians this morning, and they were marveling at something they've known for 50 years and longer, and that it took three guys like us to get the conversation really rolling.
Fantastic. And I want to return in a few minutes to the reception of the book and some of your commentary about the different ways in which the battle has been remembered over the years. But let's first of all go into the first half of the book, which basically covers the history of the battle. You recount this history in chronological fashion and, of course, pay particular attention to challenging some of the mythologies that have grown up around the battle. Let's talk about some of those myths and some of the ways in which you try to set the record straight in the book. First of all, some very basic questions about Texas history. You talk some at the very beginning of the book about why it was that Anglos came from the United States into Texas in the first place. Chris, what is the mythology that surrounds that question, and what do you offer by way of answering that question in the book?
Well, you know, I'm a fifth generation Texan. I grew up here, and the stories that I heard in fourth and seventh grade is that it was a continuation of the American dream, that the Anglos who had settled the original 13 colonies were working their way west, and that they had come to start new lives on virgin soils to spread their society. And it was a society founded in equality and fairness for all people. And that it was only when an oppressive Mexican dictator came along that they felt the need to raise up their arms and fight for liberty. You know, what we know now is that the land was going bad in the South from over-farming of cotton. Farms were failing. People wanted fresh land to grow cotton. Right across the Sabine River was Texas, with almost exactly the same kind of soil. And they wanted a chance to build new lives here, but it was based on the idea of slavery, of bringing slaves and farming cotton the way they farmed cotton in the rest of the country. And, you know, you look at who came here, why they came here, and what they went to work doing as soon as they arrived. And it was all about cotton, and cotton was all about slavery.
And talk a little bit, if you would, Brian, about the attitude of the Mexican government towards slavery in Texas. This strikes me as one of the really interesting points that you develop in the first part of the book.
Yeah, this was always a marriage of inconvenience, if you will. The Mexican government, which became independent in 1821 after the toppling of the Spanish government, needed settlers. It needed people in Texas to act as a buffer against an onslaught of Native American, mostly Comanche, attacks during the 18-teens. And they were desperate just to get some people up here. Otherwise, they were talking about having to abandon Texas. As luck would have it, down on his luck, a fellow named Moses Austin, later his son Stephen F. Austin, came in and wanted to settle the first families. And for a while there, everything went fairly well. The problem came because the Mexican government was stridently abolitionist. They were a government and a nation of mixed races. And for them, the idea of one race lording it over, or actually owning another, was anathema. From the earliest years of the Texian, the American colonist presence in Texas, Stephen F. Austin fought with the bureaucracy of Mexico to keep slavery. And every new Mexican government, and there was one about every 18 months, every prime minister, every emperor, everyone came in and said, nope, this time no more slaves. And Austin somehow would get them to delay 12 or 18 months. Every time this happens, slave-owning Texans, and it's a lot of them because one in four people in Texas at this point are enslaved, the Anglos begin packing and say, that's it, we can't do it. If you're not going to ensure the sanctity of our greatest single asset, which was not land, it was the slaves, then we're leaving. Well, after about 15 years of this, as we show in the book, the Texans finally put away their suitcases and they took out their guns.
And I would add that this is where it kind of dovetails with the traditionalist narrative. While slavery was outlawed in the rest of Mexico, the federal constitution allowed Texas and Coahuila to keep it. And so when the traditionalists say, they were fighting not over slavery, they were fighting over the suspension of the Federalist Constitution and the concentration of power with Santa Anna. Well, the reason why the Federalist Constitution was important was because it allowed slavery. So they're making our argument for us when they say, no, it was about federalism versus centralism, not slavery. Well, the only thing that made the federal constitution useful was that it allowed slavery.
When you hear the term federalism in the discussion of the Texas Revolt, it's basically a code word for slavery.
Now, Chris, tell us how this simmering dispute over slavery results in the revolt that gives way to the Battle of the Alamo and all of the familiar history of Texas's origin story. What is it that led to that rebellion?
Well, it was the new Mexican government, the decision they made to bar slavery, and then their decision to bar lifelong indentured servitude, which was what the Texians came up with as slavery by another name. You add in the posting of Mexican troops in Anglo communities where they were supposed to collect tariffs and make sure that the Anglos obeyed Mexican law, which they were required to do as Mexican citizens and as immigrants to Mexico. It didn't take long for people to start picking up their weapons.
We argue in the book, Mark, that every revolution essentially has two components. The underlying cause, which we argue is slavery. If you don't believe the underlying cause is the important thing, you end up believing the American Revolution was about tea. The triggering event here was when Santa Anna, who'd given us a tax amnesty of a couple of years, decided to actually, you know, collect taxes. And a hothead named William Barrett Travis, yes, that William Barrett Travis, raided a Mexican military garrison. And when the Mexican government came in to arrest these troublemakers, that was the triggering event for the revolt.
Now, Chris, talk about how it is that the Alamo becomes the focal point, at least for a time, of events in Texas. What has been the mythology around this question, and what did you discover in your research?
Well, the Alamo really started to be penetrating American culture and society with the silent movies. And it kind of reached its apotheosis in the 1950s with the Walt Disney TV series and the John Wayne movie, The Alamo. And it was a biblical story. It is about people sacrificing their lives so others may live. And the funny thing is that before the movies came out, no one really cared about the Alamo. In fact, in 1886, the San Antonio Express News editorial page proclaimed that it was a shame that no one was bothering to remember the Alamo, that it was basically a warehouse full of whiskey and bushels of corn and leather goods. There was no commemoration of the battle or the place. In fact, the Battle of San Jacinto, where Sam Houston defeated the Mexican army, that was the big thing to celebrate. And so basically from that point forward, from 1886 forward, it became a project of heritage groups like the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. And it took on this biblical and often very political point of view. We see in the early films about the Alamo that it was portrayed as a battle of good white people against evil brown people. Santa Anna is portrayed as attempting to rape white women, and that's why the Texans rebelled. And so it takes on this conservative racist tone that unfortunately sticks with us today.
Going back to the actual history of the battle for just a moment, one of the questions that has long interested me is why it was that the defenders of the Alamo stayed there despite knowing the size and strength of the military force that was coming. Clearly, there's a mythology that surrounds this question. They were there to defend liberty and to buy time for the raising of a proper army to defend Texas. But what did you discover in your research about how best to answer that question?
Well, that's a tough one to answer because there is no answer to the $64,000 question. Why did Travis and Bowie stay at the Alamo, which was all but indefensible, when they knew a Mexican army, you know, that outnumbered them, what was it, Chris, 30-1, was on its way? There's a number of pieces of evidence that are circumstantial, but added together tend to answer the question. The first is Travis and many of the other officers just simply didn't believe that Santa Anna could be on his way. They thought he would wait longer, later to the spring when there was more water for the horses, more grass for the horses. And worse, it appears, reading between the lines, that a lot of these warnings were brought in by Tejano scouts, mixed-race scouts in some cases, and Travis, being an ardent Southern Alabama-raised racist, just didn't believe these guys at all. Neither did Sam Houston, for that matter. Nobody really seemed to believe that Santa Anna was coming, except for the Tejanos who lived in San Antonio, who began loading their carts and getting out there because they knew what was coming and they knew it wouldn't be pretty. One can also argue on Travis's behalf that he believed that the reinforcements that he was writing these beautiful flowery letters asking for would certainly be coming. And alas, other than a single contingent of men from Gonzales, they did not come. Houston did not send people. And in fact, the Alamo's defenders were trapped there, which leads to the major question, which is the heart of this legend has always been that the Alamo defenders decided to stay there to fight for freedom, to fight for civilization, and to curry time for Sam Houston to build an army. The historical record just simply does not bear this out. The fact is, they got trapped. They waited too long. And once Santa Anna showed up, there was no escape. Did they fight valiantly to their death? Yes, in the way that all, you know, surrounded men attacked, no doubt, fight to their death. But it wasn't like there was any conscious choice to do this.
Now, we've been using the names of these iconic figures of the Battle of the Alamo already throughout this interview. But let's zero in a little bit more tightly on these three individuals you call the Holy Trinity of the Alamo story. Let's talk a little bit about each one of these characters, how they've been mythologized over the years, and what you all have discovered. First of all, Davy Crockett. I think he probably belongs at the top of the list in terms of his familiarity to most Americans. What's the lore that surrounds Crockett, and what have you discovered in your research? Chris, why don't you take that one?
Well, you know, if they're the Holy Trinity, he was the father. He was 49 years old. He was already well-known, already a celebrity in the United States, as much for being a bumpkin as being an Indian fighter or being a politician. But he brought with him a little entourage and a certain level of fame. But, you know, he was not a leader. He was there as a private soldier. He was not an officer. He was going to take commands like everyone else. He was there for the same reason as almost all the rest of them. If he fought and he survived, the new Republic of Texas would give him land, and he would have an opportunity to begin his life anew and probably run for president of Texas if given the chance. Supposedly, he goes down swinging old Betsy over his head, fighting to his death, as portrayed by John Wayne or Fess Parker. And we know he didn't do that. He surrendered. Mexican officers say that he tried to pass himself off as a naturalist who just kind of accidentally got caught up in the battle. Santa Anna was having none of it and executed him. So that Davy did not go down fighting. Hate to burst that bubble, but... it's the truth.
Brian, tell us something about another one of the iconic figures, Jim Bowie.
Bowie is the one that I was most surprised to learn about because, you know, Jim Bowie is this, he's the Steve McQueen of the Alamo. He's this tragic figure struck down by some unknown disease who fights to his death in his deathbed. And while all that may be true, it's also entirely true that Jim Bowie, while also famous in his day, mostly for a duel that he fought back in 1827, was a criminal. Jim Bowie came to Texas in part because he had to flee the U.S. because after an early career trading illegal African slaves, he launched into a massive fraud of stealing newly opened federal lands by forging land documents in northern Louisiana. When that was found out, a series of federal investigations ensued, and he tried it again in Arkansas. And when the feds came after him again, he decided this sounds like a good time to immigrate to Texas, as a lot of people like Travis with paths and difficulties did in those days. Bowie came to San Antonio long before the revolt, married a daughter of one of the wealthiest men in town who bankrolled any number of his kind of harebrained money-making ideas, none of which made any money. And by the time of the Texas Revolt, the gentleman who bankrolled and his wife had died, I believe, of cholera. And it's probably an overstatement to say that Bowie was a drunk on the streets of San Antonio, but he was hiding in a bottle, and the people of San Antonio were making fun of him. They called him famously Jim Bowie the Braggart. But because he had such a reputation as a fighting man, a well-earned reputation, I think we'd say. You know, he quickly rose within the ranks to a position of prominence and became a co-commander of the Alamo with William Barrett Travis.
And speaking of Travis, let's talk a little bit about him, the third of the trio, the central trio of your story. Chris, what can you tell us about William Barrett Travis?
Well, he's my cousin. He was the cousin of my great great grandmother's, born in Conecuh County, Alabama, near the town of Evergreen. He married young, got a wife young, studied law, but then killed a man for messing with his wife and had to flee Alabama. Came to Texas. He was all of 26 when he was fighting at the Alamo. And yet in his diary, he bragged about bedding 56 women and kept careful track of taking these little blue mercury pills, which were typically prescribed for syphilis. He is known to be really prickly, self-important, preening, if you will, He was despised by Sam Houston, and that may be one reason why Sam didn't send any help. He was not trusted by his men, who overwhelmingly wanted to be commanded by Jim Bowie instead of him. But unfortunately, Bowie fell ill, and there was only one commander left, and that was Travis.
Travis's great skill, though, and it's really the reason that we remember the Alamo today, and that it has gone down in history, was as, in essence, a PR man, writing these letters back to the Texas Provisional Government, to Sam Houston, imploring them to send men to help him fight off the mongrel hordes who were threatening white civilization in Texas. And it's really those letters, which don't have an awful lot of basis, in fact, are the reason that we're talking about Travis today, and the reason that we're still talking about the Alamo today, because without Travis's letters, this is just a foolhardy defense of a frontier fort.
Now, let's talk a little bit about really the second half of your book, where you when you turn from the history of the battle itself to the ways in which the battle has been remembered. For a long time, as I think Chris mentioned a little bit earlier, the battle was sort of lost. It wasn't something that got a lot of certainly scholarly attention. Not many people were doing serious research on it. It just didn't figure that significantly in the way that Americans thought about American history, or for that matter, Texas history. And then it seems to make a big comeback starting in the 1960s for some of the reasons you've already mentioned. But let's come to that that important moment when the Alamo starts to reappear on the American screen, quite literally, but the radar screen in a more figurative sense for the country. What is it that accounts for that surge of interest in the Alamo that really has never gone away?
I attribute it to a gray and aging revolutionary cadre. By 1886, most of the fighters were either dead or dying. It was also after the Civil War when there was this huge remembrance movement to remember the war dead and remember the sons and fathers and uncles and cousins that died in war. And it was also a time of reconciliation after the Civil War, where people didn't want to think about slavery as the cause of the Civil War. Well, Texans had this other war they could take pride in. And so you have the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. You have women like Adina de Zavala, who was the granddaughter of Lorenzo de Zavala, the first vice president of the Republic of Texas, who's looking at these old missions and thinking, we have to save our history. She was a schoolmarm. She recruits Clara Driscoll, the wealthiest woman in Texas, all of 19, when her mother dies and she's at a loss of what to do with her life and her fortune. And suddenly she remembers that her grandfathers, both of them, had fought at the Battle of San Jacinto. And so it was an opportunity to portray and remember their ancestors as Greek warriors, as the heroes of these romantic novels that they were reading. And so that, I think was the beginning of really trying to remember the Alamo. You add in some Jim Crow thinking and some white supremacy and the need to justify white rule over people of color. And you've got this perfect recipe.
It was in part because of, in large part because of Clara Driscoll's efforts to publicize the Alamo, that it was known at all through the first half of the 20th century. But even by World War II, Mark, you would probably have to say that the Alamo remained very much a Texas thing. And it was really only when Walt Disney himself wanted to make a series of TV shows and movies that would highlight what we now call patriotic values or family values. He was very concerned about the rise of international communism, that he stumbled upon Davy Crockett and thus the Alamo story. And it was three things in quick succession: the incredible success of these Disney movies, the John Wayne movie, and then LBJ in the White House in the 60s, who never met an Alamo story he didn't love. That's really what catapulted kind of a Texas thing, a regional thing, into the international icon that the Alamo's become today.
Now, while I'm sitting here interviewing you two gentlemen, I'm sitting in the LBJ Library, so I can't resist the opportunity to ask you a question or two about Lyndon Johnson's role in your story. You have some really interesting passages about his role in creating some of the myths around the Alamo. Let's go a little deeper on that. Chris, what can you tell us about what it was that Lyndon Johnson claimed about the Alamo and the interpretation of events that he tended to dwell on in many of his speeches and comments?
Well, you know, LBJ, like every good Texan, doesn't mind elaborating on a true story to make it a little more interesting. And you see this over time with Johnson. You know, he starts out with the rather accurate description of his grandfather writing the bill for the Texas legislature that would save the Alamo from destruction and make it a permanent fixture of Texas society, a historic place. That becomes an ancestor fighting and dying at the Alamo in the course of like six short years. And of course, when a reporter points out, you know, Mr. President, no, your ancestor did not fight at the Alamo. No one from your family fought at the Alamo. All he could do is throw up his hands and say, why do you have to ruin a good story? But more importantly, Johnson used the Alamo as a metaphor for South Vietnam. He said, you know, the South Vietnamese are just like the defenders of the Alamo. They're trying to fight off an oppressive regime. They're outnumbered. I'm not going to be Sam Houston. I'm going to send reinforcements to the Alamo, i.e. Saigon. And it kind of informed all of his ideas about all of these anti-communism forces around the world. And I think, like so many Americans and Texans, they keep forgetting, we lost the Alamo. You don't want it to be like the Alamo. We lost.
Really fascinating. It seems to me the ways in which the Alamo was remembered during the 1950s, 60s, 70s had so much to do with the Cold War context. I'm just curious, did you find other instances going beyond LBJ where American leaders used the Alamo as a metaphor in the conduct of American foreign policy during that period?
Yeah, it became you see it in the 50s. With an awful lot of generals, as well as inevitably Texas politicians, who began using it more and more. Over time, it kind of morphed into a stalwart of conservative, politically conservative speech. The Alamo became, I wouldn't say captive to American conservatism, but I will say that it's become awful popular with them, in part because of conservatives feeling that they're surrounded, that their values, traditional values, are suffering under an onslaught of people of color, much like the Alamo. As we look back now, I think we mark the 1960s as really the high water mark of what we call the Anglo-centric narrative, LBJ's narrative, if you will. And it was around that time, really, that finally, after 115, 120 years, that academics and popular writers began asking the hard questions that they'd never asked before.
Chris, it seems to me one of the most powerful parts of the book is where you really delve, and Brian, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but where you really delve into the question of what has been the cost of this version of history to Latino and Latina citizens of Texas and of the country, I suppose, more broadly. Could you talk a little bit about how you approach that subject in the book?
Sure. Well, you know, the Alamo has been used as justification for oppressing Mexican Americans since the early 1900s. Governor Oscar Colquitt, who sent the Texas Rangers to basically be death squads along the border with Mexico, killing both Americans and Mexicans of Hispanic descent, loved the Alamo. He loved to talk about the Alamo. In the 50s and 60s, you see conservatives use the Alamo as a stand-in for fighting off the communist hordes, particularly Chinese or the South Vietnamese, or as a substitute for Anglo supremacy. Anglo exceptionalism. And of course, you know, in fourth and seventh grade, a lot of Texas school children get drugged to the Alamo for a tour. And a very large percentage of these school children are Hispanics or Latino, Chicano, Tejano. We like to let people use their own labels. And that is the moment that they learn that, you know, they're not really Texan. They're not really American. Their ancestors are the ones who killed Davy. You know, we talk to Tejanos of a certain age, you know, everywhere from in their 30s to their 80s. And all of them start telling us these stories, these moments where suddenly their Anglo friends turned on them because of the Alamo story. And you see this in the popular writing of many Tejanos as well. So we saw an opportunity there to tell those stories, to let them share in their voice, their experiences. And as Brian said, you know, when we were reporting this out, I was down in San Antonio interviewing these people coming back, and I'd mention at a dinner party what I'd been doing. And none of my Anglo friends had ever imagined that this was at all harmful to anybody. It was just a good, rollicking story. But, you know, you talk to Hispanic San Antonians of a certain age, and they're like, I've never been to the Alamo since. I never want to go again, and I really don't care what happens to it. And that's because of the stories that were drilled into their head when they were young.
One of the stories that you really bring to life is that of Juan Seguin, whose experiences, and even more importantly, the way in which his story has been understood over the years since his role in history played out, really tends to capture the ways in which the Tejano part of the story has dropped out. Can you talk a little bit about Juan Seguin and how his role in the events of the 19th century have faded from memory? Brian, let's go to you on that.
Well, if there's one story that you should know of one individual in the Texas Revolt, it's not Travis, Bowie, or Crockett. It's Juan Seguin. It is a metaphor for all that has been done to the Tejanos then and since. Seguin was a prominent member of perhaps one of the two or three wealthiest families in San Antonio. The Tejanos early on, before the revolt, were ardent allies of the Texians, of the American colonists, in large part because there was now somebody that they could actually do business with. And whenever Stephen F. Austin and others were trying to fight for slavery in Mexico with the Mexican governments, Seguin and his peers were their lobbyists and best allies. Seguin wanted to fight against Santa Anna for entirely different reasons, because he believed Santa Anna was on his way to being a tyrant. So a de facto alliance came together during the revolt. Seguin was a leading commander. He was at the Alamo until he got out just in time, and he led a cavalry unit at San Jacinto. Many of his scouts were those down on the border early on, warning that Santa Anna was on his way. Afterwards, Seguin, you know, rose to become, as you would expect, one of the top military commanders in Texas. He was essentially the commander of San Antonio until newly emboldened Anglo settlers began pouring into areas of Texas where they hadn't yet lived before, the traditionally Tejano lands around San Jacinto, along the coast and down to the valley. And many, if not most, of these incoming Anglos were hardcore racist Southerners who couldn't much tell the difference between somebody who was their slave and some brown guy named Juan. You know, they just didn't seem much different. Before long, long story short, Seguin ran afoul of some of these fellows, and Seguin ended up being hounded through the streets of San Antonio, literally chased from hacienda to hacienda, from ranch to ranch, as each was burned. And he ultimately, after a series of kind of trumped up charges that questioned his loyalty, ended up in a Mexican jail, where the Mexican government said, well, you can either go back and fight these people, as he did alongside the Mexican military and the Mexican-American War, or you can just stay in a dungeon. And, you know, it was a sad, very sad story that symbolizes all the betrayal of the Tejanos. Seguin ultimately was able to come back and retire quietly in the town of Seguin. But, you know, it's a heck of a story in that when you look at all the first histories in the 1800s, many of which are not very good, inevitably they have little or nothing to say about Seguin and his peers and the crucial role that they played not only in early Texas, but in the Texas Revolt itself.
It's pretty clear that attitudes toward the Alamo tend to correlate with political outlook. But do you think that attitudes toward the Alamo is also a generational phenomenon? In other words, do you see that alternative revisionist points of view are more apt to take hold with younger Americans who are perhaps less wedded to older ways of thinking?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I mean, you can see it in the generation today, the younger people, millennials and Gen Z, who don't seem to have much need for the Alamo or its story at all. As recently as the late 1990s, Texas schools were teaching a more well-rounded, more balanced view of the battle. And again, just like in the 1880s, we have a generation that's reaching a certain age, and they're beginning to notice that their stories, that their legends, that their the things that they care about are not being taught anymore. And so in the 2000s, you see this huge shift away from a more progressive, well-rounded perspective in Texas public school teaching standards. And you see this hard shift to the right, where now it's required by law that Texas history teachers tell students that everyone who fought from inside the Alamo was a hero. Mm-hmm. And I think this is really tied to the boomers, people who grew up with Davy Crockett on television and wore coonskin caps and had little toy rifles, people who went to see John Wayne in the movies portraying Davy Crockett before they were drafted to go to Vietnam. That generation is still the second largest living generation today, and they're also much more conservative. But if you look at younger folks, those stories don't resonate. It's just not their thing.
I agree with everything Chris said. The only thing I would add is it's important to understand that there is in Texas something that does not exist in other states, and that is something that we and others call Texas exceptionalism. The idea that our state, in large part because of its history, is somehow a cut above the Delawares and North Dakotas at the world. The one thing that we have, those who want to believe that Texas is special and that they, as Texans, are somehow special. And I have to say, back in the day, I was much the same. I wore the T-shirts. I would joke around with Yankees about this type of thing. The Alamo and the Texas creation myth are at the beating heart of Texas exceptionalism. They're the only thing, you know, that makes us significantly different from an Iowa or a Nebraska. And it's one of the reasons that you see people, especially people of a certain age, cling to them so desperately when they believe that they're under attack. And obviously the sad thing is the story that is being, quote, under attack is a legend. This book, Forget the Alamo, which builds, we should say, on two generations of academic research, is just an attempt to recover the actual Alamo, the historic Alamo, and try, if we can, to slowly discard or quickly discard the Alamo of legend.
Exactly. So let me come back to the title, Forget the Alamo. I think your message is pretty clearly not that we should all just forget about the Alamo, it's that we should forget the mythologized version of the Alamo and recover that deeper, truer history of these really complicated events. But tell me, is there a version of the battle that we as citizens of Texas could come together around that would be productive to a healthier political climate and greater understanding across different categories of the population?
I think the key is to remember all 300 years of the Alamo story, not just 13 days in 1836. You know, because all those other years, they count. They all either shaped what became the Battle of the Alamo, or they've shaped what we think happened at the Alamo. You know, I like to say that we have to forget the Alamo myths to remember the historic Alamo properly. That's, to me, where the title comes from. And part of remembering the Alamo accurately is to say, you know what? A lot of those people who died, a lot of the Mexican soldiers who died at the Alamo, were conscripts who were fighting for their country. You know, the Alamo, San Antonio, Texas, was part of Mexico. A group of foreigners, many of whom who crossed the border illegally, were trying to steal a third of Mexican territory. That's why Santa Anna and his men marched on the Alamo. That's why they fought. Because it was not a true army, it was a bunch of rabble rousers. Santa Anna considered them to be pirates, people involved in international crime, not a legitimate military force. And as such, under international law, he had the legal right to execute everyone at the Alamo for trying to steal his nation's sovereign territory. If we could just tell that story with the same amount of excitement as we tell the story of people who felt their liberty was being infringed and that their economic way of life was about to be tossed out, and therefore they had to fight an oppressive government. Yeah, let's tell both of those stories. They're both true, and they have the benefit of being accurate.
You say in the introduction of the book that there's never been such a good time as right now to have a meaningful discussion about the meaning of the Alamo. Why do you say that? What is it about this particular moment that makes this such a good time, and apparently a very productive time, given the response that's been generated by your book, to have this conversation?
We make that argument through both a political and a demographic lens. Politically, culturally, you know, there's no denying that the country is undergoing a sweeping reassessment of its racial past. We see this in black and white issues every day. We see this with Confederate statues. And yet, the heroes of the Texas Revolt, the heroes of the Alamo, have largely been given a pass, given that they were fighting to create what became literally the most ardent pro-slavery nation the world has ever known. But demographically, we're near a tipping point. Anglos, Chris, you correct me if I'm wrong in the numbers. Anglos are what now? Only 41% of the Texas populace. Latinos are poised to become a majority during almost any year. And there's a real sense that this long-lived legend of the Anglo-centric narrative is not one that sits quite well with our Latino about-to-be majority. And so we say, given that, there's never been, and given what's going on with this cultural reassessment, there's really never been a better time for us to have this debate, for us to try to talk about what actually happened rather than what we wish would have happened. Unfortunately, our book has dropped at a moment of incredible political polarization in the country and in Texas. This was not, I should say, written. We're not, Chris and Jason are not politicians. We didn't write this with anything political in mind. We wrote this because we're into history, if you will. We like writing about history. We like the facts of history. We're proud Texans. But we don't really believe that knowing the truth about the Texas Revolt and about Texas history makes the state or its people any less special.
Well, Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson, I wish you the very best in your efforts to provoke a really productive and healthy debate, which would be very good for, I think, the state and our country more generally. Congratulations on a terrific book, and thank you so much for making time to be with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you, Mark.
My thanks to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and as always, to you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.